Welcome to Novo Ed Talks, where we reveal real-world strategies and expert insights from learning and development professionals. In every episode, we chat with practitioners, course designers, learning strategists, and business leads. We hear about their experiences in the learning industry and predictions for the profession and the trends that they're seeing. But before we get started, a little bit about Novo Ed. Founded at Stanford's Social Algorithms Lab in 2012, Novo Ed is a people-centric, capability-building platform that combines social and collaborative learning to drive performance readiness at scale. Through cohort-based experiences centered around human interaction, Novo Ed taps into collective wisdom, placing each learner at the center of perspective, application, and expertise. Large enterprises such as 3M, GE, Marriott International, and Nestle partner with Novo Ed to accelerate their critical initiatives, reconnect teams, and achieve rapid alignment through learning that is felt, experienced, and swiftly transformed into impact. Now, let's meet our guest for today's episode.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Novo Ed Talks podcast, a podcast for training trailblazers to get real. My name is Melissa Fisk, and I am the producer of the Novo Ed Talks podcast. And today I am joined by Andrea Gregg, who is the director of learning experience design and an associate research professor at Penn State. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us. A quick little bio about Andrea is Andrea has a PhD in learning design and technology, and her 20 plus year career has been dedicated to maximizing quality in online education and has balanced scholarly research with applied learning design and faculty development practices. She presents frequently and is widely published and a co-author of the 2024 Routledge book, High Impact Design for Online Courses, Blueprinting Quality Digital Learning in 8 Practical Steps. She has also received the Robert M. Gagne Award for Graduate Student Research in Instructional Design. So Andrea, it is such a pleasure to have you today, and I'm sure we're going to be hearing all about instructional design and all your experience. Why don't you go ahead by kind of expanding upon that introduction and talking about your role and a little bit about what you do.
Okay, awesome. Thank you, Melissa. Excited to talk to you all about kind of my passion for, as you heard from that introduction, instructional design, learning experience design, and a big focus on the learner and the learning process. So like Melissa said, I have been in this gig kind of a while. I used to say that I fell into it, but after you've done it for long enough and then got an advanced degree in it, it's hard to say you just fell into it. But I would say that kind of my day-to-day, in the current position I'm in, about a year and a half ago, I was asked to co-lead for the College of Engineering at Penn State, developing an infrastructure for micro-credentials. So these are short courses, competency-based, awarded with a digital badge. It's very exciting. As my co-lead and I always say, it's like building a startup in the middle of higher ed, which bring some interesting challenges and opportunities. It's also really stretching me from a learning design perspective because our audience has greatly expanded from engineering students, undergrad and grad, to working professionals, engineers with minimum 4-year degrees up to PhDs. And then on the other end of the education continuum, we are doing workforce development with folks that may have a high school degree, may have a 2-year degree. So widely different audiences, which is a lot of fun. I also do, like Melissa said, educational research. I would say broadly, my lens is always on the learning side of it, either looking at the learner's actual experiences and or learning performance as kind of defined by the faculty, in our case, in a corporate setting would be the SME. And the other big thing recently that Melissa mentioned is the book. So my co-authors and I, sort of from our collected too many years to name, experience in designing for online context, realized that there wasn't a targeted model for online learning. We found that there are lots of models and they're awesome and we incorporated them. But starting from the get-go, from day one of the design process, assuming your learner is online and then stepping through our 8 steps to kind of have a final blueprint before you go to your LMS, your CMS, and actually create your course or create your training. That's what that book is about. It's High Impact Design for Online Courses. If you ever hear one of us present, we will call it HIDOC. And our goal is that HIDOC becomes as kind of recognizable long-term as ADDIE is to most of us in the ID field.
Wow, that's awesome. And such a great asset, I feel like, for so many folks everywhere. You mentioned who some of your learners are and how they kind of go from student to graduate to those in the workforce. Do you have like a common theme of what maybe some of their biggest challenges are?
Yeah, I think everyone kind of learned this through COVID. I think those of us in the online field were sort of stomping our feet saying, we already knew this. But it's harder to learn online. It's just harder, especially asynchronously. It requires so many more of those variables or constructs that are talked about in educational psychology. Motivation, self-efficacy, self-determination, down to the smallest thing of time management. So I would say whether it's a graduate student in a mechanical engineering program or a student who might be taking one of our micro-credentials targeting manufacturing, that the challenges they encounter are it's harder to sit yourself down and learn because of all those things. So the burden, and this is what I always say to the, again, I say faculty, but in broader context, subject matter experts, is we have to be thinking about the end user. The content is crucial, but it's not king. What's king is how we facilitate that learning so they get what you want them to get out of the content. But if we keep focusing on the content, how we present it, how we make it look pretty, how we make it look cool, and don't really target from a learning perspective how they're taking it in, what's keeping them going? What's do they know where to click next? It's obvious to us. Is it obvious to them? So those kind of things, I would say, are absolutely consistent across learners.
Yeah, absolutely. And how do you kind of approach some of those challenges, or how do you suggest that folks approach those challenges?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So I work with mostly engineers currently. My background that I didn't mention is I sort of grew up within Penn State World Campus, which was hard to realize given sort of the proliferation of online higher ed. But we were one of the trailblazers, one of the very earliest online higher education campuses. So I started as an ID, I managed a team, I then shifted a little bit as I got my PhD into research and evaluation. And now I kind of do a hodgepodge. So I do ID, I do research, I am working, like I said, on developing this larger infrastructure for offering micro-credentials. But one of the things that I will say now working with engineers is there's a respect of expertise and a respect of science. And I think that we know so much more about how the brain works from a learning perspective than we did 10 years ago, whether it's from evolutions in learning sciences, neuroscience. So I try, there are some very quick, very helpful videos that show sort of how the brain creates new neural pathways. And I'm not a neuroscientist, so I am probably stumbling over this. And if there are any watching, I apologize for anything I'm misstating, but we know more about how it is more effective to have a 5-minute video and then a quiz than it is to have a 60-minute video and then a test, just from how the brain works, how it takes in information. It is more effective to have content contextualized for whatever your learner's context is than to give it decontextualized. So I try to just approach kind of like colleague to colleague. We have different sets of expertise, and this is mine. And ultimately, I want the learners to get your expertise. And the best way to do that is to do things like chunking, repeated assessments, those kind of things. So I would say just a lot of conversations. And the other thing is feedback. So, a lot of times people kind of don't hear what you're saying until they've taught and read student feedback or gotten questions that you might have said, this is going to be confusing, this is too much content. And then as they're teaching or training, they're getting feedback of, I'm really confused, this is too much. Or in the survey, it comes up. So that's the other thing is I always make sure. And if there's something that's not objective or it's kind of like on the fence, I'll say, you know what, let's put it in your way. Let's see if it comes up in the survey. Let's ask about it. Let's look at the analytics. So I think data, qualitative and quantitative, is really important as well.
Absolutely. And that it's so important too, because I think so in whatever anyone does when it's their, you know, kind of like bread and butter of what they're doing, it's like, of course this makes sense to you, but you know, does it make sense to who, like who is going to actually be consuming this content and the way in which they're going to be consuming this content? Because that's changed so much too, where it's not just like what environment are they in? Right. And like all of
them. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
How do you kind of measure some of the KPIs, if you have any, or the effectiveness of programs? Like, do you have a set way that you advise folks do that?
Yeah, I think generally my approach is what we would say in research, mixed methods. What, you know, I think seeing, for some people, seeing numbers is really helpful. So surveys that might even rate something as simple as learner satisfaction can have an impact, especially if they're comparing it to different experiences. But I also think that it's really important to look at kind of more qualitative. So it could be actual artifacts that they're producing in the course or in the training, and then things that they're saying about their learning experience. Because I love this saying, and I certainly didn't invent this, but not everything that matters can be measured. Not everything that can be measured matters. So I think that there are things that, like, take an engineering course, you can assess for certain things, but there's tons of things you're not getting just because you didn't ask that question or didn't do that. So we're only really able to kind of look at what we're measuring. So I guess another thing, sort of more objectively, is, and this is really relevant now with these micro credentials, are people signing up for our courses? Are people paying to take these micros? Are they finishing? So they're more objective KPIs, kind of in that broader sense. I would say in an individual learning sense, I look at learner feedback and learner products. So what are they actually doing? How are they doing on the tests? How are they doing? I recently worked on, it's a mechanics course. It's actually a machine design course, and it's tends to be large enrolling. So there are limits with what learners can actually do hands-on. So the instructor and I, he's a mechanical engineering professor, we developed with students, actually the students developed it, a virtual reality application where the students in the class now go in and, because he can't have them all 100 students assembling a gearbox, but he can have all 100 students go to a VR space and assemble a gearbox. And we did some pretty close evaluation of, did the VR make a difference? Did it make a difference in their confidence in these things? Did it make a difference in their performance on objective questions? So that's a kind of more micro level KPI. If you take it that way. I don't think in higher ed we tend to talk about KPIs from a learning perspective, but yeah, a key performance indicator. Did they do better when they had the VR than when they didn't?
Yeah. And I think that's a great point you make too, is like that you can have KPIs, but to your point of, you know, comparing it to other experiences or even just like adding in simple things or changing things up and then like comparing it to the experience of not having it, I think is incredibly important and sometimes gets missed, you know, or it's like, oh, let's just measure for X, Y, and Z, but then it's like, okay, compared to what, and is it improving? And did you change everything completely? And then how do you kind of measure that compared to something else? You talked a little bit about that VR example, which is great, but do you have another example or do you want to expand upon that example of a successful case study of an L&D initiative that kind of significantly impacted performance?
Yeah, so these kind of are still in the evaluation bucket, But I will say one of my most favorite projects over the years has been, I was involved in a user interface study, user experience study, when the university was transitioning from one learning management system to another. And a group of us wanted to make sure when online courses were designed in this new learning management system that we were doing it well, effectively, et cetera. And my colleague who had sort of kind of initially spearheaded this kept saying, I came from web marketing. You would never just release a page without testing it with users. I can't believe in education we release courses without ever having a learner look at it. So she kind of had that passion, and I brought a lot of the research and sort of the structured approach. But what we did was we had students, it's called Think Aloud Observation, where you have students go through a course in this case, but it could be a website, it could be a product, it could be anything, perform what are fairly straightforward tasks like submit this assignment, email your instructor, and then talk aloud while they're doing it. So I think I should click here, but I'm a little confused because this button says submit, but the assignment told me to upload. So which is it? So you're capturing live data of what they're actually thinking. And I would say the biggest impact from that was with the permission of our participants, we then showed those videos to the instructional designers who had designed those courses. And I was in one meeting where the designer was watching a student fumble around with, and she said, it's right there, click it, it's right there. And what it really emphasized was our mindset when we're designing is not their mindset when they're taking the course. Or and it's true with any kind of web usability. So that had a big impact, I think, in terms of IDs seeing this is better than this because this confuses students, this doesn't. So I think it led to some kind of concrete changes. Another one more recent, and this seems so simple, we are doing for these short courses, one of the evaluation questions that I added, and we're doing it for every course, is like, let's say a short course is on project management and it has three learning objectives, which we are saying are the equivalent of the badge competencies. In the survey, we list each learning objective and say, you know, on a scale of 1 to 6, rate how effectively you can now do this task. Because I think with IDs, we always say, you need to start with your learning objectives. You need to assess your learning objectives. But it's also important to know, does the learner now feel like they can actually do what we're saying they can do? So that has impacted a lot of the faculty saying, whoa, this one, I didn't realize like I wasn't teaching this one well because they rated this learning objective really low, where the others they rated high, which shows something is missing. Even though you think you're taught it, even though you think you designed assessments for it, they're not getting that. So that was another thing I think, again, these are a little indirect. It kind of goes through the professor, through the designer, but ways that I've seen things change pretty quickly based on observing learners.
Absolutely. I absolutely love that you do the like recording of the learner and have the learner kind of talk to it because, you know, a lot of times you can do like web recordings or see someone's like, you know, that's like very easy to do and like see how someone's like mouse is
the navigation.
Moving.
Yep.
Yeah. But like that doesn't give you that extra added layer of context. Like, what are they thinking? Like, are they just pausing to like look at their phone to do something?
Exactly.
Or are they really like actually like, hey, I can't find this.
Yeah.
So that's really, really
it's
cool.
It's a very fun method. It's awkward because
I'm sure
nobody wants to sit there and like externalize, I'm confused. I don't know where this is. I don't know what this word is, but it requires kind of coaching, but it's a lot of fun. Steve Krug who wrote Don't Make Me Think, Web Usability, and then Rocket Science Made Easy. And it's all about web usability. They're excellent books, super practical. And he gives a lot of stuff away for free on his website in terms of like sample questions. But he says, you can sit in a boardroom and debate for, you know, days and days and days about what should be on the homepage. And you're going to have marketing as a different perspective than
yeah.
sales, than tech support. Sit a learner down, watch them try to get around, have them tell you where they're confused, then fix your design. So it's so practical, but we so rarely do it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, with so many things, I think it's because we're just like, no, this makes sense. And it's like, no, it doesn't, you know, like, yeah. I'm telling you it doesn't. So we need
I
to
did
change.
a UX training years ago. And I think they gave everyone like a button that said, you are not your users.
Yes.
So your mentality, your thing, you're not your user, whether you're an expert, whether you're a designer, whether you're a trainer, et cetera.
Right. Exactly. You talked a little bit about, you know, how you're using different aspects of technology, but could you expand upon that? Like what role technology does play in your L&D programs? And if there are specific like tools or platforms that you're constantly leveraging?
Yeah. So I would say that in engineering, a lot of it is taught video because there's a lot of equations and explaining and demonstration. So just video tools, whether it's video editing or hosting, transcribing and closed captioning are a really big deal. And then I would say interaction tools and animation tools. So I have a meeting later to talk to someone about H5P and how we can get some more interactive kind of questions after content. And those are all important. I think that small things can make a big difference with learning that don't have to be like VR is a big deal. It takes a long time. It's really complicated. The coding is complicated. It has tons of potential. It's awesome. Like we've seen it work, but you can also just slap a quiz question into a training or a course that's just a very simple multiple choice, and you've done something to improve their learning. So I think with technology, it doesn't always have to be complicated to make a difference. And obviously, generative AI, I think that everyone is trying to figure out kind of what should we be doing, what shouldn't we be doing, where do we outsource, what can't be outsourced. And I heard someone, his whole career has been in IT coding, software development. And he said, this is going to change things more than the internet changed things in terms of education and everything. So, I mean, try to think about that for those of you kind of who remember before the internet to the internet, like it disrupted literally everything from how we fly, how we stay places, how we get food, all of the things. So to think about that with Gen AI is pretty mind-boggling and overwhelming. But I think that we're all sort of figuring that out. Like, what should people be using? What shouldn't they? How do we embrace it, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. We talk about that a lot at NovoEd, and just, you know, it's not a matter of like whether or not it is going to be involved. It's
yes.
How it's and like how
it, absolutely, like there's no question. I mean, I'm literally right now in a friendly, not debate, but just back and forth with a colleague where because of accessibility, we need to send these videos out. The auto transcripts are near perfect. And a year ago, not the case. Like a year ago, I would never have said use an auto transcript. I'm a little surprised that I'm the one saying we should use the auto transcript. It is, and these are technical topics. It's getting equation terms. It's getting, and it is near perfect. So, you know, it's you don't want people to lose jobs, right? Because I'm aware when I'm saying we should use this, that somebody whose job is to transcribe, now I'm taking work from them. But it's also hard to justify spending money to have something transcribed when it's done right here. So yeah, that's just a tiny example, but it's like that, you know, times a million in terms of what's happening.
Sure, absolutely. Kind of along those same lines, thinking about just like the industry and learning and development in general, What have you seen as kind of the big changes over the past 5 years? What are some key takeaways?
I think that the use of video, and this kind of like you could trace this with the evolution of social media, right? So I think there was something even before, again, completely dating myself. I don't know if it was like Friendster, then MySpace, then Facebook, then Instagram, then TikTok. I mean, Snapchat's in there somewhere, but it started text with an occasional image to almost entirely images to almost entirely video. And I would say in terms of teaching and learning, there's been that transition as well. With the addition of interactive tools and animation tools like Vyond or scenario-based tools, you know, where your branch scenarios like that you people do in Articulate Storyline, that you're kind of, do you go here, do you go here? So I would say that's also just become so much more commonplace and integrated into training.
Yeah, absolutely. And so crazy too. I love, you know, that analogy that you gave, just because it's, if you really take a step back and like think about it too, it's almost evolved so like naturally to us. Like you don't really think about how important that has been or how impactful that has been and how much it has changed things.
But yeah, the media has gotten richer. So it used to be that, I mean, when I started in this field, we were still doing paper-based correspondence. And to have a video of a professor was bandwidth prohibitive.
Right.
And things have changed so dramatically now, you can watch it on your phone. So, and that has just been extremely rapid. So I think that the technology sort of evolved in, I don't want to say parallel, but the fact that Wi-Fi has improved has allowed, or just internet has allowed the richness of the technology or of what you're interacting with to evolve with that.
Yeah, absolutely. As you know, we've looked back, but now, you know, looking forward, what do you kind of see with the future of L&D? You know, what trends or emerging technologies do you think are really going to help shape the way, you know, we invest in L&D or what we see in L&D? And obviously you mentioned Gen AI. I don't know if you want to expand upon that or if there's other things that you think we'll see come about in the next 5 years.
Yeah, I would say generative AI is probably 99% of the most major thing. But that said, it impacts kind of everything. It impacts not only how we produce learning, but how humans learn. So we tend to focus on wherever our positionality is, right? How can I use Gen AI to create this thing in Photoshop rather than going and taking a picture? How can I use Gen AI to put in learning objectives and ask it to design assessments for me? So that's the positionality of an ID, a trainer, et cetera. But then from a learner perspective, how can I use Gen AI to take this video and give me key points out of it, to take this text and summarize it? So we have to realize that all these shortcuts we're using, learners are using. I mean, think of ourselves. Like, if you have a video, do you want to watch the whole thing? Do you want just the key points? No, it depends on the content. It depends on, you know, a number of factors. But I think we're not always thinking, the conversations that I've been in, we tend to talk about how we can use it to be more efficient with our own time. And then we forget to flip it and realize learners are doing this as well. So I was at a conference a while ago, and I was in the expo hall, and I passed a booth, and the booth was for generating content from, you know, keywords or whatever, like use Gen AI to help you write this up. And then I passed another booth that was about synthesizing and reducing content, upload a PDF and get the main points. So there's something kind of existential about, are we generating content? So we're having a machine generate something for a machine to reduce back down. So There's a lot. It's pretty mind-boggling. But yeah, I think that there's no question from the design and the learning perspective that's going to disrupt sort of everything.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up because it's true. Like even on like in some of these episodes that we've done, everyone talks about how it's going to shape what, they're doing and their role in like course creation and things like that. But, I think we're like, oh, learners, they'll like be like creating content or like try and like, the first example that comes to mind is like, oh, everyone's trying to like write papers with like AI. Like that's a very small piece of it. They're going to doing it, thinking just like critically, just like how we are thinking critically about creating courses and content and things like that, about how to more quickly consume content, because that's just part of what we do now is quickly. So thank you for sharing that. As our last question, Andrea, what advice would you give to those just stepping into a leadership role or potentially like a role comparable to yours where you're working with, IDs creating course content?
I think so, kind of reflecting on my own experiences going through that trajectory, I would say two things, and I didn't come up with either of these. But they're just the two truisms that I have found most applicable to me. First is kind of, again, did not make this up, but what got you here won't get you there. So typically, if you're being promoted, it might be because you got an advanced degree. It might be because you're an excellent designer, you're an excellent developer. But that's not what you're now hired to do. You're now hired to lead, to manage, to do these other things. So realize that you need to develop a new set of skills. So leadership and management aren't the same skill set as instructional design or, learning experience design, content development, all those things. So I think don't be scared to get development yourself and realize that you can be a great designer and a terrible manager of instructional design designers if you don't figure out kind of the competencies of management. So that's the first. The second is live in your strengths. So my co-lead and I, for these micro credentials, we have completely complementary strengths and we don't say weaknesses, so opportunities for growth. So she's an extrovert, she's huge big picture thinker. I'm an introvert. I tend to focus on the details. Left to our own devices, we can miss things, right? She can miss details, I can miss the big picture. So live in your strength, realize what you're good at, and then augment the rest. So don't try to be like a kind of leader that you're not, but realize that whatever kind of leader you are, you're not going to be able to do it all. So if you're a big picture kind of always on a new project thing, make sure you've got someone keeping you accountable to the details, or that you just delegate that and make sure that they're covered. And on the flip, if you're more introverted or reflective, make sure that you've got people who are kind of pushing things ahead or handling even just like the social part of your team. So I would say those are kind of the two things that for my own development and leadership, I found most helpful and true.
Yeah, I love those. And that's a big one too with the if you're more a big picture type, we see that in I feel like so many different organizations, right? Where there's someone who's like the dreamer is like, oh, we could do this, we could do this, we could do this, and they almost never get into the details. And it's like, hey, your ideas are not going to come to life unless you are here. And if you can't do it, just make sure that there's someone is there. And I absolutely love that. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. And you obviously have a wealth of experience in all of this. And I think you've made it very easy to kind of digest and consume for those that may not have as much experience. So thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a lot of fun. So I appreciate you inviting me on.
Absolutely. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in once again to NovoEd Talk.